Bridging Eastern Parkway, the Crown Heights History Project, interview with the Reverend Dr. Clive E. Neal, Bedford Central Presbyterian Church, the 29th of July, 1993. First, let me just start out by asking you where you were born and when.
Born in Jamaica, West Indies, in 1959, in central part of Jamaica called Mandeville in the parish of Manchester, and came to this country in 1978.
And why did you immigrate?
Primarily for educational purposes. After high school, I came to the States for college and went to Philadelphia Eastern College for my undergraduate school, and there majored in biology.
And how did you come up when you... What route did you take from Jamaica?
From Jamaica to Philadelphia.
Straight to Philadelphia?
Straight to Philadelphia.
Okay. And
from college.
When did you come to New York?
After graduation in Philadelphia, I went to Princeton University for graduate work. And after finishing up my graduate work, I went to work in the South Bronx for 5 years.
And what did you do there? Minister?
Both. I've always have done both, both as a psychotherapist and as a clergy pastor. So I did both in the South Bronx.
And when did you come to Brooklyn?
1988, June 1988, I came to Brooklyn, to the Bedford Central Church located here in Crown Heights, Bed-Stuy, as we talked.
Right on the border.
Right on the border.
Okay. Let me ask you, just to step back a minute, a few questions about Jamaica. The Jamaicans are a rather large group in Brooklyn now, particularly in this area. What are the misperceptions that people in this area have of Jamaicans? Or do we have them?
I think there are two things happen here. Maybe about 15, 20 years ago, there was one perception of Jamaicans coming to the area primarily at that time was because those who immigrated were primarily the cream of the crop, those who have professional aspirations, those who are coming primarily for schools, and those would have been either some of the best professional persons or the best students coming here. And so 15, 20 years ago, perception was that they were hardworking persons primarily coming here to better themselves and to return to Jamaica for the advancement of the country. Presently, the perception primarily because of the drug infiltration, there is also the perception that Jamaicans are involved in both crimes and in the drug trafficking, primarily marijuana.
What would you like us to know about Jamaica and Jamaicans for that matter?
I think the country, in terms of majority's population, speaks for itself. In terms of the larger percentage of Jamaicans who are here are still hardworking, strongly persons who are goal-oriented, have the highest regard for education and for work, and anxious to own property. And so the country itself is extremely a country that has strong values in terms of family. Jamaicans are highly family-oriented people, persons who are determined to advance themselves both economically, socially, and otherwise. That it's a country who is extremely religious in its outlook. And so you find quite a few Jamaicans who are strongly religious in their orientation here. So I think a person's perception in terms of what a Jamaican need to be noted for is in its best export, which is people, and who are strong leadership oriented. You find Jamaicans in various organizations or in the workplace exerting extreme strong leadership.
When you came to the United States, did you come with any family members?
Came by myself.
Yeah. Have any joined you?
Just one sister is here in the Bronx. All the others are home. I'm the younger boy, the youngest boy, and so all the others are persons with families and homes and jobs, so it wouldn't be in their best interest to come once they have established themselves.
Right. How much contact do you have with Jamaica and your family in Jamaica?
Quite a lot, as indicated by my phone bill. That we stay in, it's a large family, but we stay in touch constantly. And of course, my mom and dad visits periodically. As a matter of fact, my mom is here now on a visit. So there's a constant visitation. We stay in contact very closely.
Was your family important to you when you resettled here? Were they significant in helping you?
It was not in terms of financially, because they couldn't. I'm from a family of very low means in financially, so they couldn't help me financially, so I had to use my feet. I played soccer, so I was able to obtain a soccer scholarship and kind of pay my way through college. What they offered me was even more substantial than money, was a sense of value and how to survive in a foreign land when you didn't know anybody, but had to recognize that you're here for your own self-betterment, and also the values that they convey in terms of my faith, in terms of hard work, in terms of my determination to achieve my goal. They impress upon me important not to get sidetracked.
When you came, were there available any organizations of immigrant Jamaicans to assistance or benevolent organizations?
Not in my college. There weren't nothing Caribbean at all, or West Indian at all. What was there was a Black Students Association that I got connected up to, and I was also wise to get, I played soccer, so the soccer team became like your primary support group, since you spend so much time together. And along with that was the Black Student League, as it was called then, that defined support, and also sang in the college choir. So maybe those three areas was areas of support, but they weren't directed towards my ethnicity at all.
Okay. What expectations did you have about immigrating?
There are two things happen to most persons who come here when they immigrate. Is that the impression that is given in your own country of America is that it's lack any kind of poverty or hunger. You only see so-called the glamour of this country. So one of the realities that dawned on us is when we get here is to see the reality of life, that it's the poverty, you have both extreme, the extreme poverty and also the extreme wealth. So in terms of expectation, my expectation that this country afforded me was educationally. I saw it as an opportunity to better myself educationally, which would have been more difficult back home because of a space in the university. So this afforded me the opportunity to have gotten academic credential very quickly. And so I saw it primarily as a fulfillment of my expectation academically.
Did you have any regrets about immigrating?
The first semester was maybe the most difficult because, as you know, Jamaica is a tropical island and it's warm. And when I came here, I ran into about October, November, ran into the snow and the winter. And so that first semester was extremely, especially going into January, was extremely difficult coping. And at that time, I was wondering if it was worth it to have stayed in the cold, or should I go back home? And the whole issue of missing family, totally isolated, was a very painful experience to overcome. So at those times, I had thoughts about packing up and going back home, because of the weather and also the readjustment to a new kind of people.
How did your experiences in college and graduate school, because I mean, that's a sort of fantastic journey you just described, from the Caribbean to Philadelphia to Princeton to the South Bronx. How did those experiences prepare you for the move to Crown Heights?
That's a tough one, because they are two different kinds of school. In Philadelphia, I had a chance much more to rub head with the real world than I did at Princeton. Princeton, as great as it is really an isolated city, from far away from reality. So there were two kind of experiences. In Philadelphia, I had a chance to be in West Philly and to work in West Philly, and so forth. So I was able to touch base very quickly. In Princeton, it was a different atmosphere. There's a whole mentality, a whole Princeton aura and the academic challenges there are high, but the courses are not really oriented towards the inner city. So when I made that decision to go into the inner city, most people were surprised because most Princetonians really don't move into the city. They try to move towards a suburban atmosphere. So the preparation was primary because I made a deliberate attempt on the weekends to be in the inner city, whether it's in Trenton, when I was at Princeton, or in West Philly, when I was in Philadelphia. But what both of them offered in the balance to that is that they were both white, predominantly white institutions. And so it at least gave me the opportunity to be in a contact with mixed races before I got into the colonized situation.
Now you said you purposely sought out the inner city.
Yes.
Why was that?
I felt that's where the needs were the greatest. You know, for my weekend work in Trenton and in Princeton, it was my observation that my contribution could be greater where the need was greatest. And so I went both through the South Bronx, which is Bed-Stuy here is a suburb versus the realities of the South Bronx. I went to the South Bronx for those 5 years and did my part in terms of trying to make a small difference in both in the community and the lives of the people, and then came here to Crown Heights, which is the same kind of situation where there's a definite need for black persons to be committed to the neighborhood.
Now you came to Brooklyn in
1988. 88, yes.
Okay. Bedford Central, your congregation is who? Is it local people mostly, or?
Yes, we maybe have about 70% local people from the community who lives around here in the community. The rest, we have all our members of, maybe we have maybe 2 members from Queens, but they're primarily from Brooklyn, with about 60-70% right here from the Bed-Stuy community.
Okay, the immediate area. Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the ethnic makeup?
We have maybe about 2% whites, you know, who have still remained here, primarily Irish, who are still here, 2%. And then the rest, we have 23 countries represented in this church. Heavily, that we include heavily Caribbean from all the countries, primarily in the Caribbean area, and also from Africa, quite a few from various countries in Africa who are here, and then black Americans. So that would be the mix. But 23 different countries represented in the church.
Has that been an important part of the ministry to draw in people from various backgrounds?
Yes, we have. You know, we have. What usually happens in a church like this is a person who come from the various country, either make an attempt to bring in others from the particular country, so they themselves will do their own personal recruiting, or the other person who come in and just like the mixture of persons, because there's no one so-called accent that dominates, or no one cultural influence on the congregation. People like the mix, and it's enriching, especially educationally. Persons are able to tap into the cultural mix and gain education way beyond any kind of narrow confines of one part of the country, you know, and being the main source of one edification.
What has that resulted in? Has that brought some positive experience?
The main thing, maybe two things. One is a tolerance for other people. It has really given a tolerance for other people. I don't make a big thing of my Jamaican-ness here at all. I broaden the category whether in terms of the African-ness of us all, which is an important thing for me. So the tolerance is important, but also the educational part I would like to mention, because people are able to learn about each other way beyond their respective culture, and secondly, gain appreciation for other person's culture beyond themselves. So there's a so-called dominant culture in the congregation, because everybody's culture is equally important.
And how do you manifest that? And is that done by education? Is it done in courses? Is it done in
Both in courses. We have institute twice a year, in which we may celebrate, talk about the various cultures, or we may, what we did this past week was look at the African origin of Christianity as a church and talk about what that means to us as a people. We have also had during African Heritage Month to have different countries get up and teach us their histories. You know, for 5 minutes they would tell us some important facts about the individual countries that sometimes we most of us did not. So education will be the primary area. One is also to make people feel comfortable wearing their native dress, whatever that is. And of course we have, we call it International Week, where people are able to display their various foods and music and so forth and celebrate that within the context of the church.
You said very interestingly that there's a rather wide cultural mix here at the church. Is there also a wide disparity in the class mix? Is there a wide economic disparity, or are most of your congregants?
It wouldn't be. You may have maybe about maximum. Well, let me put it this way. Most of our members professionally would be in the middle class area, and I know that those are kind of fragile categories these days.
Right.
But they would be, a lot of teachers, and they would consider themselves mid-class with the salary they get. A lot of teachers, a lot of nurses, and then just a few independent business persons in the construction, automotive business. But professional, they would be teachers and people in the field of education and nurses. So they'd be in that category. At all, we don't have any millionaires in the church at all. We may have maybe 1%, who may be in the upper class.
Okay.
But most of them would fall in the middle class, lower class area.
Earlier, you mentioned families when you were talking about the church and the experience of the church. How important are families to this ministry?
Extremely important, redefined. We can talk about what should be and what is. And so what I have done here in the last 5 years in my prayer ministry was to, there are two things we're working on. We're working very deliberately with black men in our congregation, in the community. We have developed a program for that, the black men. But secondly, we are working with what is, which is primarily churches made up of single women and children. That's where single, and that's part of what we have inherited due to economic disparity and so forth. But the what is that most of the people in the church are women and children, and so whatever the unit of the household is, we classify that as family and work with that, not to give those who have so-called male, female, children in the home, a dog in a car, that's the only family. We try to make sure that everybody has that sense of family as a unit. Whatever your unit is in your respective household, we work with that as family, as much as we're trying to develop our men's ministry.
And the men's ministry includes what?
Primarily, what we are trying to do is to work with men in the context of the church, to remind them, primarily men in the community, in terms of teaching, in terms of workshop, in terms of seminar, bringing person to the seminar, to remind them that the church is not for women and children, that they themselves has a vital role, both in terms of the imagery for the young men, that we all need role models. How can you be what you haven't seen? Judge Pensions' popular statement. But also to let them know that in God's divine plan, that God has a vital role for them to play in their respective household. And so if our young men and young women are going to be able to develop into constructive citizens, they can't do it by looking at the wind, meaning the absent fathers, that they have to have male image around that's going to somehow teach them that role. And I remind them through the story I was told about Christ himself, that despite that the birth of Christ was a miraculous birth, where Mary didn't need a male to impregnate her, God still provided Joseph. God told Joseph not to leave but to stay in the household to give his son Christ a male image. That's how important God thinks the male image was in the home.
Okay. And so that is in response to a number of social and economic problems.
Definitely. Okay. You know, and also it's in the, for the survival of the community, if the black community is going to survive in any kind of realistic sense, it's going to need a male, you know, to survive. Because they are the protectors of the family. And if they don't have the male around, then we're in trouble.
That's a very interesting redescription of the role of a church. Your church isn't just then a place to come sit down and pray.
No, you can do it at home.
Okay. So what is your church? If you had to sum it all up, what are you trying to create?
I'm trying to let the community know that, number one, whatever the God intended church to be, it intended to be what we call not a corpse, but a corpus. It's a living organism, meaning it has to be constantly reformed and in process of reforming itself. So it has to be relevant. So the church has to be relevant to every single needs that is being examined in the community. So for our church, we said two things. One is that our church has to be relevant to the needs of the community. Whatever it takes to reach those who are on the outside, we need to do that. Secondly, that the church has an educational function. We cannot underestimate the importance of the educational function, and that the church needs to be constantly involved in educating persons, number one, about who they are, what their purpose in life is, because a person with a sense of purpose is a person with a sense of willpower. And we need willpower if we're going to survive and make a contribution to the future.
You also do counseling.
Yes, I do. Okay. Counseling.
How important have families been in orienting people to this new life? I mean, you've got a number of people coming from other countries into Crown Heights. How important have families been in sort of helping them to adjust that new life?
Usually, you know, for what happened to every person who come to this country, whether you're family or not, is that you go through that 6 months, 1 year, very few times falls within under 6 months, that painful adjustment from your native country to this land. So finding any kind of support system is like a drowning man catching at a straw. You're hoping that's what allow and cushion the pain for those first 6 months. So you try to help families to establish themselves both mentally and economically as much as possible before receiving other persons. And what this country, you know, does, as you know, is to keep people so busy that sometimes it destroys, you know, whatever the sense of community that families are supposed to have. So we work with families, both in the unit family, meaning the biological family, but also as a church family, to help in any way with the adjustment that persons from various countries experience upon arrival here.
Okay. Does the church reach out to any other community organizations?
Yes, we are involved in the association of two, the Association of Brooklyn Clergy and Elected Official, which is a citywide organization. Each borough has its own. There's one here that meets at the House of the Lord. President Reverend Daughtry is the president. That's one. We're also part of the Brooklyn Ecumenical Clergy Association of Clergy Fellowship, which is much more of an organization concerned with housing issue, health issue, AIDS issue, and that's Marvin Owens is the executive director of that one, and they meet at Mount Sinai Church, where Reverend Curtis Whitney is a pastor. So those are two organizations that we are presently involved. As we speak now, there is an organization in the process of being formed. As a matter of fact, we can say it's formed, called Central Brooklyn Churches, which I think is going to be the organization to address some of the particular needs in this Crownite area. We are using the philosophy that comes out of IAF, that Industrial Areas Foundation, as evident in their work in East New York, East New York churches that build what is known across the country as the Nehemiah Homes. We are forming the same organization here in Central Brooklyn, which we really believe in what we call a broad-based organization with broad-based empowerment. You really empower persons from the bottom up. And so that's coming to fruition now, and there are about 25 churches, strong churches for the first time, who have become a part of that.
And the ultimate goal of that is going to be housing or...
We don't know.
The whole package.
It's always right now is the whole package, mm-hmm. because whatever the people in the community needs, that's how we work. It could be the primary needs, maybe for a particular community, maybe just to clean up the drugs. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what we need to put our emphasis. That's one way for a particular community. The other one could be housing. We know there's a tremendous housing needs around here. And what they were able to do in the Nehemiah homes was to sell single-family homes for $35,000. That was the history behind this. We were able to sell single-family homes, three-bedroom, where you have your own land space. Not apartment buildings, single-family homes. And now they're building at $3,000. That's going to be sold for $55,000. So I'm just saying, you know, that may be the need around here, because once people own property, then they have a sense of ownership of their community.
That seems like a rather dynamic project. Is it important for this church to be involved in community-wide or city-wide?
I think what happened to most of us clergy around here, and recently they have been what we call the change of the guards in this community. Primarily, the pastors who are now pastoring the so-called large churches are young ministers. You know, whether it's Concord with Gary Simpson, who he's 29, and Ollie Griffin down here at Berean. You know, 34, you know, True Font of Emmanuel. There's a new movement of younger pastors in here. And what we have discovered, if we're going to survive as churches, we have to come together and start doing some major, major impacting project that will hold our community together. Otherwise, we're going to have empty churches. So part of it's our own self-interest for our own survival, but also recognizing that we can't work individually. There is definite power and strength. And what the churches have been always able to do is produce people. If we have nothing else, we can produce people.
That's an interesting point, that young ministers are all of a sudden sweeping into the churches of Brooklyn. What other changes do you see that bringing to religious life in the community?
Well, there's also, it's going to be much more, I'm using this word guardedly, but much more honesty in terms of ministry. The clergy who are coming into, they'll have to do much more counseling than our predecessors had to, because the needs of people's lives are so complex and so painful that you can no longer preach at people or preach to people without touching them during the week. And so the new clergy who are coming in now out of their various graduate schools are persons who are taking the therapeutic aspect of ministry very seriously. And so they're going to be able to impact families in a much more tangible way, dealing with some of the honesty that people struggle with.
Do you think it would also help to draw younger people into churches?
Definitely. Most of the growth that, you know, we have seen here, I mean, amongst the younger people are here, my age is a part of that, but also the relevance of my sermons are part of that. Mm-hmm. You know, people see themselves, and since I don't have all the answers, they see me struggling with them. In their lives. So that older persons come and want to just give you all the answers. But, you know, at least most of the clergy who are younger now are struggling with the people as they attempt to grow, because life is an everyday struggle. And so part of it is the honesty of the struggle that, you know, the younger persons who are being attracted to our churches is out of that honesty of their own struggle.
And what sort of needs are young people coming to the church with? What are the things you find yourself addressing most often?
Young meaning what age now?
Our age, young.
Okay.
20s, 30s.
In the 20s. Sometimes in the people in their 20s are really dealing, usually, I hate to go on a quote, Erickson's, in the whole notion of wanting to give themselves to somebody in love. That's the whole issue there, that I'm ready to give myself to somebody in love. And number one, can't find somebody, or the person that I'm involved with, I can't trust them fully because of the whole bag of worms that is going on now in a society about relationship. That's one issue. The second issue is career. that persons have studied through schools, through colleges, and now after leaving are recognizing that there are no jobs out there, and they may have to reorient themselves or get retrained into another area to be able to hold on to a job. Number three is that the future doesn't look as bright as they thought it was when they did what was right. You know, gone through schools and so forth, recognizing now that although they have a degree, that, you know, they may not be able to own that home that their parents were able to own. And so economically, things have changed on them. And so all that confusion, all that wondering they were misled, by those who told them to get an education because that's the way to go. As important as that is, and they should, is that now that they have it, things are not coming together as they thought. And so there's that whole confusion personally, but also professionally.
You and I both share an idea of that you can do what's right, quote unquote, what's right, whatever that is. Is it harder to do what's right in 1993?
Most definitely. I mean, you know, and we can even sit down here and get into some deep philosophy about what's right anymore, so to speak. So people, mostly what's right for persons now comes out of their sense of their religion or their sense of value that they got from home, because there is no so-called national rightness anymore, because the words of what is right is now changed. You can lie now and call disinformation. You know, everything has changed. Our so-called what people perceive as sin in the church has now become a bad habit. You know, so the language has changed, and whatever we perceive to be wrong or right is being done by those who we once espoused as our leaders or our mentor. So it's a difficult time to walk the line of what's right and what's wrong. Persons are sometimes trying to do things that are respectful, are really doing things that will not hurt so-called the majority of people in their life. So, right and wrong could be clear for those of us who are religious, but for those people who are not religious, it's not as clear for them. Primarily because they do not have the reservoir or the tradition of a value system to fall back on. So the young boy or the young girls in the street will wipe you out and really don't think about anything wrong with that because they didn't have the value system that we have. And they don't have the kind of self-respect that we grew up with, saying that life is valuable. No, life for them is money. You perceive of having some money and they're hungry, I will kill you to get it. That, you know, don't tell me that's right or wrong, is that I got the money. Money is important. So the value system has changed. So it's very difficult now for even persons who once had a value system, because most of us, the value system we have has been acquired from our parents. And you know, we always re-examine that after we got to a certain age. And so people are constantly readapting their value system. It's a difficult time.
You had mentioned before that one of the issues that young people come to the church with is their whole life, their romantic sort of relationships. How does the church handle that sort of social activity or social problem? Does the church actually take an interventionist role or a guiding role in that?
It's a difficult thing because most times you can't. You know, as you know, relationships are very fragile, and even in therapy, you can never tell a person what decision they could make. You know, because you could be held legally responsible if they take your advice. So we try to encourage persons to do two things. One is to make sure that you develop yourself as much as possible with all the resources you have around you. Make sure that you develop yourself educationally, socially, and otherwise as much as possible. The stronger you are as an individual, the better you'll be able to give yourself to a person. So it's a matter at times of reminding person of a sense of priority. And I know this can be difficult for persons who are constantly watching the so-called time clock. But the more you are developed, the more you will have to give. Always make sure you can bring something to the table into any relationship you're involved. Make sure you will bring something to the table. So primarily through lectures, through sermons, through worship and so forth, we try to let people know that we were not created to find ourselves within another person. You first need to find yourself within yourself. Because there's a misconception that a person is out there to fulfill your needs, and nobody can fulfill your needs but you.
You also mentioned earlier the Africanness of your congregation and how that's an important sort of organizing principle or a principle on which to approach them. If I walk through this area, if you walk me through this area, what would you see as the African tradition in Crown Heights or the African tradition in Brooklyn? What things would you immediately point out to me?
Well, you know, where we are right now, we are two blocks away from two communities. One is the Fulton Street, which is, as you know, you're from here, is heavily African in its orientation, not just Africans from African selling commodities, but also several African stores that is around here. That's one thing. The other thing is the Nation of Islam is very strong around here. The Muslim community is very strong with the African orientation. The man across the store, with the bookstore Hardy, a good friend, is a Muslim. So you find several Muslims. The second aspect of it are the rest of the Jamaican parts around here are heavily Rastafarian, which is from the Ethiopian concept of Haile Selassie and his contribution to the Western world. And so the Rastafarians here would also be a symbol of the Africanness of the people here from the various Caribbean islands. They would represent that aspect. So the people themselves and cultural areas here, the music you will hear around here heavily sometimes, whether it's reggae or African music, Haitian music, would represent the African culture. So you have that mixture of symbols around here.
A couple of years ago in the summer, the riots took place right up on Eastern Parkway. I don't want to get into the riots. I actually want to ask you how your church reacted to that turmoil. Or did you feel it here?
Definitely. You couldn't help but feel it in its various form. One is, as a leader of this church, one is I got involved in part of the leadership of the clergy. Because there were several leaders who take different sides to it. There was no one side that any particular leader took. I was part of a group of clergy along with Reverend Simpson, Reverend Griffin, and others, who made it very, very clear that the majority of black persons were not rioting. That's number one. That they were decent persons who were around. So we took the angle that justice should be served for whatever happened to Cato, but also to Rosenbaum, that justice should be served. But about majority of the black persons here were decent persons going about their business and going at a part of the riot. So we were able to thank our congregation for maintaining a sense of stability and not playing to the media hype during that time. So we were able to take that angle here.
Did you also find yourself having to address the pain of the experience with your congregation?
I don't know if you're going to get deeper into it, into the colonized situation, because it wasn't surprising that it happened based on at least the perception, which sometimes is more of a perception of a reality of how the Hasidic community is treated in this area. There's a perception that has been, since I arrived here, has always been there, that they're able to get whatever they want, while the black community has to struggle twice as hard and to get the minimum amount of services in this community. So the perception was always there, and so what Crown Heights maybe just brought to the forefront was a symbol of the perception. But this was a reality, was a symbol of the perception of the disparity of the communities.
Does that perception still exist? I mean,
Definitely. It still exists amongst the persons in the community. And it exists because the media hasn't helped in terms of the constant focus on the Rosenbaum murder and not a focus on the Cato murder. So it's already telling you whose life was more important. I thought both lives were equally important, and both lives and families need to achieve justice. But the media continue to propel one community as if they're the only one who is hurting. And I'm saying both communities are hurting, and if you have two hurting people, they need to be together to heal their hurt outside the media's realm.
You sit in a, I had said at the beginning, in a rather interesting spot. I mean, you're literally right between Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights. What special burden does that place on your congregation, on your ministry? And not burden necessarily in a negative way.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a sense of accountability, a responsibility we have primarily here to deal with the high level of frustration that we have both here in Crown Heights, Bed-Stuy. The frustration primarily among the teenagers who have a lot of time on their hand, the frustration that they're not sure what, if their life is going to be worth living, both in terms of, you know, violence within the community or violence outside the community, you know. So my sense of leadership primarily is trying to develop constructive ways to address the frustration of the young people, you know, constructively.
Where do those frustrations begin? I mean, is it primarily economic? Is it social? Is it the whole combination?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, multifaceted in all this, you know, in our area. The level, you know, this community, especially in the Bed-Stuy section, maybe about 60% are persons who are receiving some kind of aid, government aid, from the city or from the government. So it's a very high, you know, high percentage. So you find the frustration starting economically, not believing that they can leave and get out of the plight that they're in, and they have been locked into it. So, of course, there's a connection between poverty and crime. I've always been there. The other one is social, not having enough social outlets for them to have. You know, with the number of young people we have around here, percentage-wise, the number of outside facilities to utilize their energy constructively is minimal, percentage-wise. We have a park down the street there in Brooklyn, where there may be a good gathering, but overall we don't have enough constructive facilities here that have programs to address the needs of the percentage of young people we have in this community, which is where our church comes in.
What needs to change in this community? What does Crown Heights need most?
You know, there needs to be, and maybe that's what the guys are doing, there needs to be an appreciation equally, educationally first, and I don't know if people will have the energy if you're hungry to be thinking of the educationally. But there needs to be a really sense of appreciation culturally of all the various people who lives in the community. You know, it has to start with a sense of, number one, each person, which is what's part of our struggle, is appreciating our uniqueness as African, Caribbean, African-American persons. And recognizing that we have made a contribution to this area, and many people don't understand that we have made a contribution to this area. They think we have just been Johnny come lately and have inherited something that other persons have built. And so we need to recognize that we have made a serious contribution to the Bed-Stuy Crown Heights history in the past, and is making one in the present. That's number one. Number two, that we need to understand also that there is a that if we can respect ourselves, then we need to start respecting other person's culture equally. That we are equally important, and no one ethnic group is more important than the other. And that's going to only take place when we can find ourselves involved in serious dialogue, and that learning about each other through the eyes or the guise of negativity via the media. Because most of what people know about the people in Bed-Stuy, as indicated before, are not about the Jews in Bed-Stuy, is through the media. You know, when people are coexisting effectively in Crown Heights.
So it's being defined from outside.
Right? Definitely. I wish about, you know, the media in their 22nd commercial oriented news try to get across the people, you know, their impression of what is. Right. And since persons gain most of the information via the media, they take it as gospel.
Thank you, Reverend. Yeah.